Thanks for coming out tonight. The weather wasn't anywhere near as severe as the last time we tried this with Craig. My name is Harry Bright, and I'm the director of Marsh University of Management Press. And I have to say, you know, we publish a lot of books, but I'm particularly excited about this book. And I think the reason that I am so excited about it is that this book addresses the reason why I started Transcendental Meditation, and that was to get enlightened. How many are here in this? How many for us was that the reason? Right. And so, you know, when I learned TM, I think there had been one published study on the benefits, the health benefits of TM, Dr. Wallace's first study in Science magazine. I wasn't even interested in that. I just wanted to hear about enlightenment, and that's the reason I started. And this is the almost the sole topic of Craig's book, is experiences of enlightenment throughout history and cultures. And with no further ado, Dr. Craig Pearson.
Thank you all for coming out tonight. I seem to have failed in inciting a snowstorm out there. Yesterday it looked pretty good that I was going to be 2 for 2. As of tonight, my average has dropped to 50%. Let's start right off by traveling back in time. All right? And let's picture a young man, 28 years old, on the southwest coast of England, right where England borders on Wales. And this young man loves to go walking. He often goes walking with his sister. And when he goes walking, he will go walking for days at a time across the countryside. He loves being out in nature. And so on this occasion, he's walking with his sister up the beautiful Wye River Valley, which is right on that border of England and Wales, with beautiful hills on either side and forests covering the hills. And he comes over one hill, and there below him on the banks of the river is a monastery. And even at this time, the monastery is in ruins. It had been built 500 years earlier, and now it's this beautiful lattice work open to the sun and the sky. And his sister walks on ahead, and he sits down. I like to think that he sits down under a tree and closes his eyes, and he feels an experience coming on. And this is the experience that he lives for. He's had this before, and he doesn't know how it comes or where it goes, but he knows when it comes. And so he sits down, eyes closed, has the experience. After a few minutes, the experience passes. He opens his eyes, stands up, resumes his walk, catches up with his sister, and continues walking for a few more days. While he's walking, words begin to take form in his mind. And finally, a few days later, when they get back home, that's the first opportunity he has to pick up a pen and a piece of paper and write these words down. And he writes them out, and what he writes is a poem, 168 lines long. He doesn't change a single line. And even though his first book of poetry is at the press being printed, he manages to get this poem included at the very end, even though the printing process has started. And in this poem of 168 lines, there are some particularly famous ones which describe that experience that he had looking over that ruined abbey. Now, these words will be familiar to many of you, but they just are classic, and they illustrate the main point that I want to make right here at the beginning. This poet describes that blessed mood in which the burden of the mystery, in which the heavy and weary weight of all this unintelligible world is lightened, that serene and blessed mood in which the affections gently lead us on, until the breath of this corporeal frame and even the motion of our human blood almost suspended, we are laid asleep in body and become a living soul, while with an eye made quiet by the power of harmony and the deep power of joy, we see into the life of things. Beautiful words. So who's the poet? Wordsworth. William Wordsworth, poet laureate of England in the 1800s. And the name of the poem, anybody? Tintern Abbey for short. Lines composed a few miles above Tintern Abbey. Now, these lines, this poem has been reprinted in, you couldn't count the number of volumes, the number of anthologies of English poetry, anthologies of world poetry. So many people have read this poem all over the world in the two centuries or more since it was written. And many papers have been written about it, PhD dissertations, many books. You couldn't count the number. And yet no one suspected, or very few people suspected, that what they were reading here was a very precise and almost scientific description of a higher state of consciousness. And not only that, but a precise description of a state of consciousness which itself forms a portal or a bridge to still higher states of consciousness. So in this one, do you remember any lines that struck you, even now that I've been talking for a few minutes? We see into the life of things. Now, do you think that when he says, we see into the life of things, after that beautiful run-up to that, he's looking around and looking at specific things? It seems inner to me. The life of things is the life that he's experiencing within. What strikes me is this, he talks about the serene and blessed mood, but you must have noticed the lines, the breath of this corporeal frame, that's my body, and even the motion of our human blood almost suspended. Now, he's writing in poetry, but this is almost the observation, the self-observation of a scientist, describing not just the condition of his mind, but the condition of his body, too. So what's the condition of his mind? Serene, blessed, silent. And the condition of his body? Breath almost suspended. Even his blood, something is happening. And those of us who recognize what we're looking at here, we're reminded now of scientific research that shows during these deep inner moments of restful alertness, restful body, alertness mind, these deep inner moments, they're characterized at their deepest moments by a very natural suspension of breath, reduction of breath rate to even moments of suspension, reduction of heart rate. Even the chemistry of the human blood reorganizes itself so that biochemicals associated with stress and anxiety are diminished and those with health and well-being are increased. So here's this beautiful passage which has been appreciated. It's not like people haven't noticed it. And in fact, Wordsworth has descriptions of this kind of experience throughout his poetry to the point where scholars sometimes refer to this kind of experience as a Wordsworthian experience. Wordsworthian experience. So they've noticed it. They've known it was special, but not known what its real significance was, and certainly haven't appreciated, you know, how it leads to higher states of consciousness, and really have not appreciated how this experience can be induced systematically. So if you know what you're looking for, if you know the characteristics of this fourth state of consciousness, then when you look through the records of history, through that lens, then you can find, if you look long enough, some really beautiful jewels. So I'd like to take you through a couple of the jewels that I have found through many years of reading and thousands of books, just to share some of these glimpses. And let's start. We have a lot of collective knowledge in this room, so I don't pretend that I'll say anything that anybody doesn't already know. But just to lay the groundwork here, let's just recap what we understand about higher states of consciousness. And let's start with the big picture. We have from Maharshi a model of seven states of consciousness altogether. And there's a phrase that Maharshi uses in connection with the seven states. He talks about the seven worlds of the seven states of consciousness. Now, why would he use the word world in connection with any of the states of consciousness? Seven worlds of the seven states of consciousness. Why is a state of consciousness a world? Different experiences, different language. Let's keep on going here. Yes. Different perception. Now, so far, all of those things could describe just the waking state. We're talking here about radically different experience of ourself and radically different experience of the world around us. So let's start with the least wakeful state, which is deep sleep. What's our experience of ourself? Zero. Experience of the environment around us? No experience whatsoever. That's quite a unique experience. Okay, next most wakeful state? Dreaming. Experience of ourself? Some experience of self, maybe, but it kind of changes. It's strange. And experience of the environment around us? Yes, illusory, phantasmagorical, if that's a word. Laws of nature are their own laws. A completely different world, strange shifts of landscape and people and events. Yes, and now next most wakeful state? Waking state, and that's the world of our desires and our activities and our relationships and our careers and our dharma and all of that. And those are the three worlds that people cycle through several times each day. And I want to just pause and observe that when you think about how different those worlds are from one another, and we cycle through those worlds every day without even thinking, wow, this is so weird to go such different experiences of ourself and the environment without thinking anything of it, such different worlds. Who constructed life to be like this? The other day I was speaking to some students and I said to them, try to imagine the most, if you were a science fiction writer, the most unusual world you could imagine. And they came up with, you know, out in space or, you know, some unusual creatures or something like that, which really amounts to just a little tweak on the waking state. Nothing like how different the worlds of deep sleep, dreaming, and waking are. Now Maharshi's telling us that there are four worlds higher than that, each one a different world, not just a tweak on the waking state, but a completely different world. And these are worlds, we understand from Maharshi, of higher consciousness, higher creativity, higher power, higher bliss, and more natural than the world that we live in now. So let's just recap. Fourth state of consciousness, eyes closed, the activity of the mind, like the waves on an ocean, settles down, settles inward, leaving just the serene, unbounded surface of the ocean, just pure consciousness, experiencing itself by itself, with no thoughts or feelings or perceptions, getting in the way of just the sea of infinite pure consciousness, pure bliss, pure being, experiencing itself. Just pure wakefulness. Not asleep, just pure awake, body deeply rested. That's the fourth state, which Maharshi calls transcendental consciousness. Fifth state, Maharshi calls cosmic consciousness, and that's simply transcendental consciousness along with waking, dreaming, and sleeping. And we arrive at that state when the nervous system has become free of stress and the mind is and body are flexible enough and consciousness is expanded enough that it can maintain the experience of unbounded awareness even while we're going about our daily experience. Next state, sixth state, Maharshi calls God consciousness. Once the nervous system is free of stress and cosmic consciousness and the mind is fully expanded inside, then the further growth takes place in our relationship, our experience of the environment around us. Senses embark on a process of refinement that culminates in the ability of us able to see the most fine, subtlest values of the relative world around us, the very subtlest, finest strata of creation, which turns out to be divine, glowing with light, the experience of the full range of God's creation. And in its most mature state, Maharshi explains to us, God consciousness brings the experience of the Creator. And if that state weren't glorious enough, one more, seventh state of consciousness, unity consciousness, that same progress of growth that took us through up to the refined perception of God consciousness continues so that within the very finest, most refined, subtlest strata of relative creation, within that we see what's essential to it, which is what? Pure consciousness, unbounded awareness. The same pure consciousness that we experienced when we closed our eyes and transcended for the first time. And we recognize that pure consciousness as ourself. And so then we see that there's no difference between us and the outer world. We still know left from right and green lights from red lights and so on. All of that's there, more brilliant than ever. But dominating our experience is the experience of unity. So when you have these characteristics so laid out, so crystal clear from Maharshi, and you know what you're looking for, then you can find these throughout history. Let me read one more related to the fourth state of consciousness. And this just is so clear. This is, if we go back even further in time, to about 2,600 years ago, to China. Hard to imagine what life was like in China. But this is Lao Tzu, the legendary founder of Taoism, and supposedly when he left the court in the capital city to go out and spend the rest of his life in the wilderness, leaving the country that he was in, leaving China, somebody at the border recognized who he was and asked him to please write down his wisdom before he left. And that is said to be the origin of the Tao Te Ching. So here's what he says, just a few simple passages. A mind free of thought, merged within itself, beholds the essence of the Tao. A mind filled with thought, identified with its own perceptions, beholds the mere forms of this world. So beholds the essence of the Tao. There's been a lot of discussion over the centuries about what is the Tao. Clearly, what is the Tao here? Mind free of thought, merged within itself, beholds the essence of the Tao. Pure consciousness, pure intelligence, the way, the unified field of all the laws of nature. And again in the Tao Te Ching, where there is silence, one finds peace. When there is silence, one finds the anchor of the universe within himself. So, beautiful words. And here's a little hint that the silence that I experience inside myself when I transcend is not just my own silence and you have your own silence and you have your own silence. What we're experiencing is the anchor of the universe, the silence at the root of everything. So we find that in so many descriptions where people realize that somehow what they're experiencing is something more than just silent awareness. It's somehow the underlying essence of everything deep inside. So that's the fourth state of consciousness, transcendental consciousness. But there's more, and let me read you a passage that I really love that to me really indicates a glimpse of the fifth state, cosmic consciousness. This is from Billie Jean King. How many know that name? One of the greatest tennis players ever, one of the greatest athletes ever, won so many Wimbledon championships. And here's what she writes in her autobiography about her peak moments on the tennis courts. This is a little longer than what I've read before, but pay attention and see if you can grab onto some phrases that you like so that you can share them with us when we're done. On my very best days, I have this fantastic, utterly unselfconscious feeling of invincibility. I don't worry about how I'm hitting the ball, and I hardly notice my opponent at all. I concentrate only on the ball in relationship to the face of my racket, which is a full-time job anyway, since no two balls ever come across over the net the same way. I appreciate what my opponent is doing, but in a very detached, abstract way, like an observer in the next room. I see her moving to her left or right, but it's almost as though there weren't any real opponent, as though I didn't know and certainly didn't care whom I was playing against. When I'm in that kind of state, I feel that tennis is an art form that's capable of moving both the player and the audience. When I'm performing at my absolute best, I think that some of the euphoria that I feel must be transmitted to the audience. All right, so what strikes you about this one? Invincibility, right. Detached and abstract, almost as though observing from the next room. Now, that could hardly be more telling. And that brings us to the characteristic of cosmic consciousness that Maharshi terms witnessing, where now, instead of the ocean of the mind being awake only at the wavy surface, now the full range of the mind is awake from the wavy surface on down to the unbounded depth. And now my experience is taking place not from up here, which is always changing, but from down here, which is never changing. Down here, deep in here, which is literally beyond space and time. So when with my awareness established, anchored in that inner field, so inward that it's beyond space and time, when I'm experiencing from that level, then quite naturally, there's a sense of separation. I'm just now not the participant in what's going on. I'm just the witness of that. And that doesn't reduce my effectiveness in activity. This is Billie Jean King talking about her very best moments on the tennis court. So mind-body coordination is even higher than before, and yet I'm almost like an observer in the next room. This is a description to me of the full range of consciousness awakened, even for a few moments on the tennis court. Now, she goes on and talks about her perfect shot. And if you want to count how many times she uses the word perfect here, you can let me know at the end. But I'll try again to grab onto some of the phrases here. I just love this. The perfect shot is another matter. They don't come along very often, but when they do, they're great. It gives me a marvelous feeling of almost perfect joy, especially if I can pull one off on the last shot of the match. I can almost feel it coming. It usually happens on one of those days when everything is just right, when the crowd is large and enthusiastic and my concentration is so perfect, it almost seems as though I'm able to transport myself beyond the turmoil on the court to some place of total peace and calm. I know where the ball is on every shot, and it always looks as big and well-defined as a basketball, just a huge thing that I couldn't miss if I wanted to. I've got perfect control of the match, my rhythm and movements are excellent, and everything's just in total balance. That perfect moment happens in all sports. It's a perfect combination of violent action taking place in an atmosphere of total tranquility. My heart pounds, my eyes get damp, my ears feel like they're wiggling, but it's also just totally peaceful. And when it happens, I want to stop the match and grab the microphone and shout, "That's what it's all about," because it is. It's not the big prize I'm going to win at the end of the match or anything else. It's just having done something that's totally pure and having experienced the perfect emotion. And I'm always sad that I can't communicate that feeling right at the moment it's happening. I can only hope that people realize what's going on. All right. How many perfects?
Seven.
So that's a lot. Emphasizing that. Any particular phrases from this that caught you? Right, not doing it for the big prize, but just for that experience. And you had to have noticed this phrase that where she says, it's a perfect combination of a violent action taking place in an atmosphere of total tranquility. So violent action up here, normal mind, waking state mind, still going on as before. In fact, peak performance, better than before. At this level, what is there? Total tranquility deep inside. This is the classic zone experience, classic experience of being in the zone where one feels as though one's performing at one's peak, even beyond one's peak, and yet you also feel as though you're hardly doing anything at all, even watching what you're doing, and the third characteristic is euphoria, bliss, going along with it. So bliss, witnessing, peak performance, who wouldn't want to live that all the time? So many people have read this book, but very few have thought or realized that what they were reading here was a description of a glimpse of a higher world, not just, you know, a kind of nicer version of the waking state, but literally a higher world of experience, as different from waking, dreaming, and sleeping as waking, dreaming, and sleeping are from each other, as waking, dreaming, and sleeping are different from transcendental consciousness. Such different worlds. And when you put transcendental consciousness together with waking, dreaming, and sleeping, which is the fifth state, there's an altogether new world. But there's more. Here I'd like to read, this is one of my favorites. I read this whenever it was last week. This is an experience by Rabindranath Tagore. He was the first person to win the Nobel Prize in Literature who was not a European. Great Indian writer, playwright, poet, travel writer. In addition to his prodigious literary output, he was a noted painter. He wrote hundreds of songs. He's the only person to have ever written the national anthem for two different countries. He wrote India's national anthem and Bangladesh's national anthem. Quite a creative man. So here he is visiting his brother in Calcutta, which even in the very early, in the late 1800s, when this took place, must have been a big and busy city. Staying with his brother, and he steps out onto the veranda, out onto the porch. And here's what happens to him from there. Where the Sadar Street ends, trees in the garden of Free School Street are visible. One morning I was standing in the veranda looking at them. The sun was slowly rising above the screen of their leaves, and as I was watching it, suddenly, in a moment, a veil seemed to be lifted from my eyes. I found the world wrapped in an inexpressible glory, with its waves of joy and beauty bursting and breaking on all sides. The thick shroud of sorrow that lay on my heart in many folds was pierced through and through by the light of the world, which was everywhere radiant. That very day, the poem known as The Fountain Awakened from Its Dream flowed on like a fountain itself. When it was finished, still the curtain did not fall on that strange vision of beauty and joy. There was nothing and no one whom I did not love at that moment. I stood on the veranda and watched the coolies as they tramped down the road. Their movements, their forms, their countenances seemed strangely wonderful to me, as if they were all moving like waves in the great ocean of the world. When one young man placed his hand upon the shoulder of another and passed laughingly by, it was a remarkable event to me. I seemed to witness in the wholeness of my vision the movements of the body of all humanity and to feel the beat of the music and the rhythm of a mystic dance. For some days, I was in this ecstatic mood. My brothers had made up their minds to go to Darjeeling, and I accompanied them. I thought I might have a fuller vision of what I had witnessed in the crowded parts of the Sadar Street if once I reached the heights of the Himalayas. But when I reached the Himalayas, the vision all departed. That was my mistake. I thought I could get at truth from the outside. But however lofting and imposing the Himalayas might be, they could not put anything real into my hands. But God, the great giver, himself can open the whole universe to our gaze in the narrow space of a single lane. I love that. So what catches your attention there? As if a veil has fallen from his eyes. Is it a tweak on the waking state? This is a different world he's experiencing. Certainly all of the values of the waking state are there, but so much more that you just have to call it a different world. I found that the world wrapped in an inexpressible glory with its waves of joy and beauty bursting and breaking on all sides. Everywhere radiant with light. So everything is shining with a light. Everything has a halo around it. Now, did that light just suddenly magically appear in the world at that moment to him? It's always there. Suddenly for that moment, somehow his senses functioned in a more refined way to allow that veil to drop and allow him to see what was always there, beauty and joy bursting everywhere, world radiant with light, everything as if part of this whole unified sea of humanity, and even the allusion there to God at the end. Not that he's experiencing God, but the sense that God is opening this experience to him in the narrow space of a single lane. Just could hardly be more beautiful and poetic. So this is yet again a whole world of experience which is ours to enjoy if the nervous system is simply functioning the way it was designed to function in its most refined value. Can I read one more from this? And this is the state that Marcy calls God consciousness, where the senses are refined to perceive that very most refined value. This one I'd like to read because it really gives a nice description of what refined perception might be. And you'll notice in this one that there's elements here that suggest even the seventh state of consciousness, unity consciousness, but primarily the emphasis is on refined perception, which is what I love about this. This comes from an English poet and literary critic named Kathleen Raine, who lived most of the last century. If any of you know Brian Aubrey in town, used to be on our literature faculty. Kathleen Raine was on his dissertation committee when he got his PhD in England. She's a specialist in William Blake, a very highly regarded poet. But when she studied at Cambridge for her undergraduate degree, her major was botany and zoology. So some of that scientific training I think you'll feel in this description that I read. There was also a hyacinth growing in an amethyst glass. I was sitting alone in an evening at my table, the Aladdin lamp lit, the fire of logs burning in the hearth. All was stilled. I was looking at the hyacinth, and as I gazed at the form of its petals and the strength of their curve as they open and curl back to reveal the mysterious flower centers with their anthers and eye-like hearts, abruptly I found that I was no longer looking at it, but was it. A distinct, indescribable, but in no way vague, still less emotional shift of consciousness into the plant itself. Or rather, I and the plant were one and indistinguishable, as if the plant were part of my consciousness. I dared scarcely breathe, held in a kind of fine attention in which I could sense the very flow of life in the cells. I was not perceiving the flower, but living it. I was aware of the life of the plant as a slow flow or circulation of a vital current of liquid light of the utmost purity. I could apprehend as a simple essence formal structure and dynamic process. This dynamic form was, as it seemed, of a spiritual, not a material order, or of a finer matter, or of matter itself perceived as spirit. There was nothing emotional about this experience, which was, on the contrary, an almost mathematical apprehension of a complex and organized whole, apprehended as whole. This whole was living, and as such inspired a sense of immaculate holiness. Living form, that is how I can best name the essence or soul of the plant. By living, I do not mean that which distinguishes animal from plant, or plant from mineral, but rather a quality possessed by all these in their different degrees. Either everything is, in this sense, living, or nothing is, this negation being the view to which materialism continually trends, for lack, as I now knew, of the immediate apprehension of life as life. The experience lasted for some time. I have no idea how long. And I returned to dull consciousness with a sense of diminution. I had never before experienced the like, nor have I since in the same degree, and yet it seemed at the same time not strange, but infinitely familiar, as if I were experiencing at last things as they are, was where I belonged, where in some sense I had always been and would always be. That almost continuous sense of exile and incompleteness of experience, which is, I suppose, the average human state, was gone like a film from sight. In these matters, to know once is to know forever. My mother, when she was over 80, confided to me an experience she had had as a girl. I have never told anyone before, she said, but I think you will understand. It was simply that sitting one day among the heather near Kielder, I saw the moor was alive. That was all, but I understood that she had seen what I had seen. Okay, so there's that little beautiful touch of unity at the beginning, but any comments on the description of the plant? The current of liquid light. Now, what a beautiful description of the very finest relative structure of creation, just the very most subtle, most rarefied, subtlest strata of creation. What is it? Liquid light. And that's available to be perceived and experienced. And she experiences it as something holy, something divine. And another thing that Marcy describes about the sixth state is when you see that most refined level, what does it evoke from within? Just a continuous upsurge of love, of appreciation for the world around us. Just overflowing love. That brings us back to that Tagore experience where he looked around and just, there's nothing and no one, he said, that I didn't love at that moment. So here what she's experiencing is that everything is alive. And at the end there was a little bit of sort of abstract philosophizing where she said, basically is saying everything in this sense, even stones, minerals, are alive. And we only have a materialistic paradigm of the world because we can't experience that ourselves. That's why. For lack of that experience, we just understand everything as inert matter. Okay, so that's a pretty fine world to live in. One last world, and then we can take some questions and then stop. And that final world, which Kathleen Rain took us right to the brink of and peered over to, is the highest state, the seventh state of consciousness, unity consciousness. And this passage that I read comes from a contemporary English writer, a woman who writes about medicine, writes about science, award-winning writer named Kathleen Rain, published a number of books. Her articles have appeared in magazines and newspapers. And when this experience takes place, she's driving around in northern England, gathering material, interviewing people for an upcoming book. So this experience, she says, takes place during a freezing night in January. It's past midnight. Her car, as she's driving around the suburbs of Manchester, lost, being pounded by a hailstorm. Okay? So, and then on top of that all, her car breaks down. So somehow, she gets a mechanic to come, and the mechanic figures out what the problem is and gets the car restarted. By now, it's still hailing. It's after 3 o'clock in the morning, and where should she stay? So the mechanic says, I have an aunt who lives just a few blocks away. I'll take you there. You know, we'll wake her up. She has a spare room. You can stay there the rest of the night. So they go there. Aunt gets up, takes Rita Carter in, takes her freezing, soaking clothes to dry, puts her in a hot bath, gets her room ready, lights a fire in the fireplace. So after the bath, Rita Carter climbs into bed. Okay, that's the setup. Here's what happens next in Rita Carter's own words. When I noted the fire, one of those built-in gas burners was still on, I thought I should probably get out of bed and switch it off. But as I looked at it, something very strange happened. I realized that I was not only looking at it from the perspective of where I lay, but weird as this may sound, I was seeing it too from within the flame itself. I was the fire, absorbed in its redness and warmth, both giving and receiving its heat. At the same time, and this was not a sequential realization, I became aware that I was also the bed, and the walls, and the window, and the sheets. myself seemed to have bled out of its boundary and infiltrated every crevice of the room. Stranger yet, I was not just in the room, but beyond it too. Although I could not literally see beyond the four walls, I seemed to be outside them as well as within. Indeed, I felt that I was everywhere and everything, embracing the most distant stars and yet also inhabiting the smallest speck of dust. All sense of space, location, boundedness, and division disappeared. As all this happened, I thought, or rather, I knew, that what I was experiencing was the real state of things, that I was part of some much greater whole, and that all my experience up until now had been in some sense unreal. Despite its peculiar nature, I felt no anxiety and, odder, no curiosity. It all felt entirely natural. I have no idea how long the feeling lasted. At some stage, I lay down and slept. In the morning, the fire, still burning, was back in its appointed location, and so was I. But unlike a dream, the experience remained crystal clear and as real and significant as it had been while it happened. Okay, so that is definitely not a tweak on the ordinary waking state. That is yet another world of experience. And just to say again, a world as different from any previous state as any of the previous states are from each other. Completely different experience of the self and its relation to the environment. Now the entire environment is experienced as nothing other than myself, nothing other than a fluctuation of my own unbounded pure consciousness, myself. So what I've tried to do in this book, before we do Q&A, I want to say that of all of the branches of Maharshi's knowledge that he's brought out over 5 decades, so many different branches into which you could invest an entire life and not exhaust them. Higher states of consciousness has been one of the most fascinating for me personally, the idea that there are higher worlds of experience and they can be developed and they can be glimpsed. And as a way of trying to somehow share my personal enthusiasm with other people, to bring people in to somehow appreciate that these higher worlds really are spectacular, they're really significant, they're important, and they've been described through history, I hit upon this notion of writing a book about higher states, and not just higher states in the abstract, but illustrated with jewels like these. So I've spent a few decades, I can't tell you how many books I've gone through. I've been on a very close first-name basis with every interlibrary loan staff person in the library since about 1980, and just panning for gold and finding these beautiful jewels and then gathering them together in one book, really jewels of experience, the peak of the peak experiences from around the world, from every culture, from China, from Islam, from Christianity, from Taoism, from just ordinary folks like Rita Carter, and putting them all together to show, number one, higher states of consciousness are real, they are very real. Number two, they are universal, they've been glimpsed in every historical epoch and every time period. And now from Maharshi we have a technique for cultivating them. We have an understanding that they are not just altered state of consciousness, they're not just wrinkles on the waking state, they represent states of higher consciousness. A developmental scale is what we have from Maharshi, that when we grow up to be grown-ups and adults, that's not the end. There are stages of enlightenment beyond that. And then thirdly, from Maharshi, we have all of the scientific research that shows that these higher states of consciousness are not some kind of mood or positive thinking or anything like that. They really depend on cultivating, purifying, and integrating the brain and the nervous system to support that experience. So that's what I've tried to do here, and I hope that it reaches outside of our movement and inspires people to go for transcendental meditation, not just to relieve stress and anxiety, which it's great at doing, but for enlightenment. So I'm happy to take any comments or questions. Dimitri.
Mm-hmm. It's good to remind us that the word what the word consciousness means. Consciousness comes from two Latin words, and it's the same thing in many languages. Con, which means with, and scire, that's the Latin pronunciation of S-C-I-R-E, which means to know. So consciousness is a way of knowing, and higher states of consciousness is a higher way of knowing, and therefore it requires a different style or operation of the nervous system. So as the system changes, then the way of knowing changes. Like in dreaming, this room could have been, you know, in an ocean liner. We wake up and it's the Dalby Hall. But is that the Dalby Hall? It's just a unified field. So if you go in a higher state of consciousness, a higher way of knowing, you will find that there is no Dr. Pearson, there is no two trees behind him, no podium. It's just the unified field, but they appear like that to another style of functioning of the nervous system.
Very good, and very good point. And what you've touched on is Marshy's two basic principles of higher states. Number one, that knowledge is different in different states of consciousness. That's our notion of each state of consciousness is its own world, and that each state of consciousness has its own unique style of physiological functioning that supports that particular way of knowing ourselves in the world. Any other comments or questions? Yeah. Wrote to the Queen of Belgium at the time. Still, there are moments when one feels free from one's own identification with human limitations and inadequacies. At such moments, one imagines that one stands on some small spot of a small planet, gazing in amazement at the cold yet profoundly moving beauty of the eternal, the unfathomable. Life and death flow into one, and there is neither evolution nor destiny, only being. We could read that two or three times and get more out of it each time, but the key lines are free from one's identification with human limitations and identities. So some sense of unbounded awareness, and life and death flow into one, and there's neither evolution nor destiny. That means there's no change. There's just being. So it's a description, it seems to me, of a glimpse of a state that's beyond change. I take that as a glimpse of transcendental consciousness. I'm imagining that his eyes are closed there. And then, of course, there's some other beautiful quotes from Einstein where he talks about this, what some people call mystical experience, is really the heart and soul of science as well as art. And he associated that kind of experience with his own creativity. Mm-hmm. Right, right. So, very good. Yes, Anil.
This is a wonderful book, and I've told you personally, it was so good, and I felt like if I had seen this book before coming here, I may not have needed to move to this place. And my experience of finding this book and reading was also very high state of consciousness. As soon as I saw it, I said, that's what I'm looking for. I bought it and read it the same day as much as I could until I got distracted with The Razor's Edge and I thought I'd watch the movie. But this whole idea of this book being so wonderful, this idea of awakening being captured in a place like that, it just drove me to a mystical space, and I just couldn't stop reading till I got distracted, as I said. And the funny thing is that beyond a point in time, somehow then it looked like just a book. So there was a moment in my own space when this book sort of raised me to a space where I really enjoyed being, you know, different from who I am in a normal state. Then after that, still books begins to look like atoms and bits, you know, back to a very ethereal kind of space. So I don't know. To me, it feels like the inspiration is within, and sometimes something outside, a book like yours, can just light the spark that we all so cherish.
I'm glad you enjoyed, and I'm sure that the hours that you spend every day in the Golden Dome had more than a little to do with that experience. Alaric.
I think it takes a gem to find the gems. But the question I have is there any distinction you found between UC and BC in your literature search?
Oh, boy. No. Not that I've found. It doesn't mean there isn't something out there lurking in some book, but I haven't found it. What Alaric is referring to, many people know, UC, Unity Consciousness, Marcia describes it, even at that highest level of consciousness, still there's some growth. And that growth is that initially in unity, the unity that I experience is at the first level of perception. But as that unity becomes more mature, more established, then even the secondary level, like the table behind or the rug behind or ultimately the universe behind, is all experienced as part of myself.
So might not Rita's experience that you said conform partly to that? Because she
actually, yes.
She went all the way out beyond what she could normally physically see and identify herself with.
Right. That was just occurring to me as you said that. And then she said inhabiting something like the farthest reaches of the universe down to the smallest speck of dust. So her consciousness encompassing larger than the largest to smaller than the smallest. And she wasn't aware of this terminology, but she's basically using the description that we have from Maharshi in the Vedic literature. Yes. Yeah, I think that the Tagore one was where he said that what he called this ecstatic mood remained with him for some days, even during this trip up to the Himalayas. So that went on for a while. Some are just momentary glimpses, but some seem to go on for days. And Bernadette Roberts, yeah. Yes, so thank you, Porter. In the UC chapter, one of the figures is Bernadette Roberts, who's a contemporary writer, and she seems to be there at the highest level. Yes.
We're so fortunate here to have Maharshi's technologies and at the foundation, the TM technique, to repeat these experiences, and how frustrating it must be for these poets and these scientists and writers to have these experiences and not know how to come back to them.
Absolutely. I don't know if I can find it easily, but Eugene Ionesco, the absurdist playwright, gives this beautiful experience of GC, and then it fades away. And as with some of these that I read, it said coming back to the normal waking state was like coming back to a world of rags and ashes in comparison. That was how he put it. And he said the experience just came so naturally. And I'm just paraphrasing now, but he says something to the effect that this experience of supernormal wakefulness, which could set the world ablaze, which could enlighten the world, is so natural and so easy. He said it should be like pressing a button. But where is the button, he says. We fumble about for the button as though on the walls of an enormous strange house. So coming back to rags, to shanties is another word. And that's in comparison to what we take as the normal adult consciousness. That's what this is when you have a taste of what the higher world is. Yeah.
Let's take one or two more, and then those who want to get books signed, I'm happy to. I don't want to keep people late.
In Dubai, I taught a young Arab boy, a teenager, TM, and he, coming out of his first experience, looked around in great amazement, and I said, "What do you experience?" He said, "I can see everything. I can see the whole universe all around me." And he said, "I don't have a thought in my mind. I just know everything." And he had that experience for all throughout the 3 days checking. So that must
wow.
have been, yeah.
It's a new generation, people born who are just waiting for their first dive. Yes.
Do you have more?
This is it for now. This is this is 518 pages, and it was painful to cut back even to this.
And how much more did you actually
have? Yeah. Two or three times as much.
Yeah,
there's just so much beautiful material that just didn't make the cut because I didn't want to. One of my other enthusiasms besides higher states is yogic flying. And what inspires me so much is, you know, besides the idea of the body lifting up from the ground, is the idea that people can get together, sit together with their eyes closed, seemingly doing nothing, and all around them, crimes rate is going down and terrorism is going down and wars are being stopped in their tracks and everything's getting better just from groups. So I wanted to bring together in one book all of the stories of all the great assemblies, Taste of Utopia, International Peace Project and World Peace Project and Lebanon and on it goes. And I guess the size of this book is a measure of how great my enthusiasm for that is. But I didn't want to write a book so big that it needed the same kind of forklift to move it around. But anyway, to answer your question, yeah, there's lots more. And if you come across things that you find in your own reading, please, I want to be a repository for those things. One more, and then, oh, yes. Christ consciousness? You'll have to tell me what you mean by that.
Christ consciousness is the Christ. Is
the Jesus appears in all four of the central chapters in Higher States. So there are brief descriptions, from the Bible of where he's referring to, where is the kingdom of God? It's within us. So it's quite clear that he's teaching about, something interior. But there are also passages that when you know what you're looking for, you can see descriptions of cosmic consciousness, God consciousness, and unity. So I feel that he, at least in terms of this framework of seven states of consciousness, that he was aware of and experienced and described all of them. Yeah, I and the Father are one. His was a teaching of unity for sure. Right. Can't quite hear. Right. I and my Father are one, and Father is not some father sitting on a throne somewhere out in space, but the Father is pure being, pure consciousness, the creator, the origin of everything. So let's wrap up, and I really appreciate you all coming. This is obviously something that we are all very passionate about. And it's really great to be in a community where everybody wants enlightenment and where we all want enlightenment for everybody in the world, and we want our whole world to be enlightened. And we're so fortunate to have the beautiful knowledge from Maharshi that really allows us to appreciate for the first time what these great geniuses throughout history were trying to tell us. Now we can look back and see just the jewels that lie in our past, all arrows towards the future that Maharshi has created for us. So thank you all again for coming tonight.